Good evening and welcome to Health Writers on the Air. These are words I use to describe health writer Judy Lerquin. Judy died this week from cancer, but her presence in our community will never leave us. As Judy's daughter Debbie said at the funeral today, she did not live to see the end of her work, and it is up to us to carry on with her mission. We are living in a time of pragmatism and capitulation, but Judy taught us never to compromise on our ideals. She stood firm, but was never abrasive. Her passion for humanity shone like a beacon. Here's a short clip of Judy speaking out against war on a Health Writers program from July of last year.
Health Writers has been in the forefront of the anti-war movement since its founding back in the early 1970s. We must end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, bring the troops home now, pay reparations to the peoples and nations we've harmed, and demand that returning troops and veterans of all wars receive needed medical care and all of the other benefits that they are entitled to. We must do this, even if it means increasing taxes on the wealthiest people and on the wealthiest corporations. We must.
This is Health Writer Steve Blank, and this program is dedicated to our beloved Judy. She lived life with her eyes wide open and was an extraordinary activist. She put herself in the shoes of the exploited and downtrodden, yet she lived her life with joy and enthusiasm. She was a mentor and a friend. Her contributions to Health Writers over the decades were enlightening and compelling and comprehensive. She articulated arguments against all social, environmental, and economic injustices. Judy Lerquin was Judy of the people, and she did a great job of reporting on the issue of health care reform, even as it applied to the disease that eventually took her life. Let's listen to some clips from an interview Judy did last year, before Obamacare was passed into law, with Dr. Sam Epstein from the Cancer Prevention Coalition.
Dr. Epstein, the Cancer Prevention Coalition has sent a letter, he sent it out on June 15th, to a number of congressional leaders recommending a major revision of the proposed Obama cancer plan, and I want to thank you for passing that letter along to me. Can you talk about some of the recommended changes?
Well, basically, the Obama cancer plan, to all intents and purposes, ignores prevention. When I say ignores, I really mean ignores. It pays no attention to avoidable causes of cancer, and it pays no attention to the escalating incidence of cancer. So we are now in the middle of a major epidemic of avoidable cancers. We have detailed scientific documentation on avoidable causes of all of these. They have been published in the scientific literature. They've been summarized by myself and by others, and published in peer-reviewed articles, scientific articles, and the information is literally unchallenged.
When you consider the powerful lobbying machine of what we call the healthcare industrial complex and their emphasis on diagnosis and cancer therapy drugs, how effective do you think is cost savings for healthcare in terms of an argument for getting this administration to put forth increases in funding for cause and prevention?
Well, there is literally no question that the failure to prevent cancer is not only a human tragedy of a desperate nature, and as a pathologist, ex-pathologist, I have done autopsies on so many people who died needlessly of cancer when avoidable causes are clearly known.
Are you hopeful that the people responsible for the final cut of the Obama cancer plan will incorporate the prevention, the coalition's recommendation, or at least some of them, into the final legislation?
Well, I have no faith whatsoever in President Obama's plans on the healthcare area.
You can hear Judy's complete interview with Dr. Sam Epstein at the Health Writers website at www.healthwriters.wordpress.com. The Health Writers Coalition will carry on with our work in the spirit and tradition of our recently departed mentors, Leah Zeldin and Judy Lerquin. Tonight we speak with Dr. Laura Dresser from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy about the decline in health care coverage provided by Wisconsin employers, and with Robin Shermer, an activist who was arrested in Chicago for standing too close to a garbage can, and then she sued the city. But first, I sat down with WORT's Norm Stockwell, who shared these thoughts about Judy Lerquin. How long did you know Judy?
I worked with Judy on so many different things over the years. It's hard to keep track, but it must have been in the mid '80s doing Central America solidarity work, and she was involved with sistering with El Salvador, with a sister community that her church was involved with, and you know, just everywhere. I mean, I think it's such a huge loss because Judy was so involved in so many things in our community. WYLU, of course, the Third World Issues show that she and Russ did for must have been over two decades. Here at WRT, working with the Health Writers Program for probably over a dozen years, doing very important interviews and talking to people about things like depleted uranium, about the situation in Haiti, about the pharmaceuticals industry and the way that it prescribes so much for so little. Those are the kinds of issues that she constantly brought to the fore in her interviews here on WORT. And, you know, she was just such a wonderful, warm, upbeat person, just always looking to build something positive. And so I think she'll be sorely missed here at WRT and throughout Madison.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare him room. And heaven and nature sing. And heaven and nature sing. And heaven and nature sing.
Dr. Laura Dresser is a labor economist and the associate director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think and do tank dedicated to improving economic performance and living standards in the state of Wisconsin and nationally. The Center on Wisconsin Strategy is based here at the University of Wisconsin, and their mission is to promote what they call high road strategies that support living wages, environmental sustainability, strong communities, and public accountability. Laura Dresser, welcome to Health Writers on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy just published a report on employer-sponsored health insurance in our state, and apparently private businesses are providing fewer employees with health coverage insurance. Give us some statistics and tell our listeners why you think this is happening.
Well, we all have known that there's a lot of stress in the health insurance system, and on a very long term, not just because of the recession, but for a very long time, rates of the coverage have been declining all across the nation. Wisconsin has always done better than other states, but even in Wisconsin, from 2000 to 2009, 300,000 Wisconsin workers lost health insurance through their employer, or 300,000 less workers today have health insurance through their employer than did 10 years ago.
And has this been affecting all segments of the population equally, or is there some disparity?
I think there's some disparity there. Workers at lower wages, we know, are much less likely to get health insurance than workers at higher wages, and that's become more true. So if you have a service sector job, a low-wage retail job or whatever, it is just much less likely today that you get health insurance through your employer. And sometimes, even if you do, it's not coverage you could even really count on.
Well, you also issued a report on the recession. Let's go back to that in September.
Yes.
And in that report, you indicated that 20% of Wisconsin workers hold poverty wage jobs in which they earn less than $10.46 an hour. And, you know, that kind of defines the state of the working class in Wisconsin as bleak. You know, they don't make enough money to make ends meet, and then they're less likely to have their employers provide them with insurance.
Yeah, only one in four of those workers working at $10.50 an hour, $10.40 an hour or below are getting employer-provided health insurance.
So that's a pretty high percentage of people in the state who are not getting covered.
Right.
So more and more of our people are, I guess, in danger of falling through the cracks, especially if they get ill. So given all the cuts in federal and state spending, coupled with what appears to be an extension of the Bush tax cuts likely, what do you recommend?
Well, you know, I think the priority at the national level has to be both on economic growth, a real stimulus that makes jobs happen, not just economic growth, but economic growth that produces jobs. It will continue to feel like a recession, whatever the growth numbers say, as long as we have so many people, so close to 10% of the population looking for jobs. But then also real health insurance reform that doesn't reward employers who manage to find a way to stop giving health insurance and so undercut competitors who provide health insurance, and that also covers the people who need the health insurance, which is all of us.
Right. I know, if I may relate an anecdote here, I know of an employer in southeastern Wisconsin who employs about 70 people, and this employer told me that he would gladly take any fines that were issued from the federal or state government for not paying health insurance for his employees, just to save money, because to him, it's just a bottom-line issue. He feels no moral imperative whatsoever to help his own employees.
Well, and I think that's the hard thing, is we've set up so much in the U.S. economy on the job. You know, in every other country, it isn't whether you work or not or where you work that defines whether you get health insurance. And this puts, you know, a lot of moral decision-making power like that on the employer.
Well,
a lot of people vulnerable.
Being that the case, then, I mean, does it make sense to have employer-based health care as opposed to a single-payer system of health care?
You know, I think in the long run, or, you know, in the international context, it's clear that a single-payer system or a system, you know, whatever the design, that covers everyone is what we need, and that does not hinge on the employer and the employment relationship. That's, you know, sort of something we got into, and it will be very hard to get out of, but we won't probably get health care right until...
However it's done, it seems to me that the business role seems to be one of the major impediments to achieving that. Who funds the Center on Wisconsin Strategy? I understand it's part of the University of Wisconsin.
We're part of the University of Wisconsin. We're a center technically located in the sociology department. We receive grants from national and regional foundations and contracts for services for our work, so we don't get any money from the state technically, but...
Let's talk about the economy in general. Certainly the report you issued on the recession indicated that jobs are not coming back at nearly a strong enough pace to keep up with the amount of jobs that were lost when the recession started. Can you give us an indication of those trends?
Yeah. The state has basically, since December 2007, which is the official national start of the recession, the state is down about 160,000 jobs, or 5% of the total job base in the state. We've had a little growth. You know, we were down at 170,000 down a while ago. But basically, we've had stagnation over the last 12 months or so. That was good news for a while, because we really were falling off a cliff back in 2009, and couldn't see the end of those job losses. So that shocking pace of loss is over. But what we are in now is, you know, a jobless recovery. So there are some positive signs in the economy, but the state is not generating jobs to get anywhere close to making up the hole that we're in, let alone, you know, making the more jobs to cover the new people that have come into the labor market, or at least have come into working age since the recession started.
I want to read for you and our listeners a quote from Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at Santa Clara University. This from a piece written for In These Times magazine this week. He's talking about how these continued tax cuts will be devastating for our economy, and he points out the fact that it used to be, when tax cuts were initiated as a stimulus way back in the Kennedy administration, businesses had to prove that they were adding jobs before they could claim the tax cuts. And then under Reagan, that began to change. And every tax cut bill passed between 2001 and 2004 was called and sold as a jobs creation bill. Yet this period between 2000 and 2004 witnessed the weakest jobs creation on record following any recession in our history. So my question to you is, what do you think is going to be the result if the Bush tax cuts are extended?
Well, you know, that was the weakest job recovery on record until we got into this one. And this job recovery is weaker. We've had this weak recovery with the cuts. I think we all know that as a stimulus, these tax cuts don't really produce jobs. And what we should be doing is pursuing stimulus investments that produce jobs, not the sort that where, you know, very rich people get to save more money. That this would work, that this will help generate, you know, a stronger economy, not very likely.
And I realize that this isn't your expertise, how to sell a marketing strategy, but how should we go about convincing the American people that these tax cuts are not in their best interest? People seem genuinely confused about this. How do we disseminate this information that you've gathered and make it accessible to such a larger group of people?
Well, part of that is, what you're doing and community media, and part of that is us trying to get the word out and trying to say things in ways that make sense. But then also partly it's this political fight at the national level. The forces that are interested in the tax cuts have a lot of material interest in them and have a lot of interest in people being confused about them, and so there's a lot to work against.
A lot of misinformation being fed through the corporate media as opposed to what we're trying to disseminate here in community radio.
Right.
Would you like to leave us with any additional thoughts this evening?
No, though. We do update. We have a product called the Job Watch, which every month gives you the latest on how we're doing in the recession on our website at cows.org. And we'll be keeping our eyes on health insurance and work issues at the center.
Laura Dresser, thank you for joining us on Health Writers.
Thank you.
I know to you I may look old. Hope this statement ain't too bold, but here comes the judge. 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 Here comes the judge.
Robin Shermer of suburban Chicago is a woman who wears a lot of hats. She was wearing a pink hat when I first met her at a Code Pink rally about 7 years ago in Chicago. She is a peace activist, but that's not how I would define her necessarily. She spends most of her time these days organizing farmers markets and educating people about the importance of eating locally grown food. She's a mother, a lawyer, and generally, not someone you would expect to end up in the slammer. But that's what happened to her. Well, let's find out more. Robin Shermer, welcome to Health Writers on the Air.
Thank you.
Now, in 2006, you were doing something called counter-recruiting at the Taste of Chicago. You were arrested that day, along with six others, and that will be the focus of our conversation. But first, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, can you explain what counter-recruitment is?
Well, in my parlance, because I didn't invent the term, but I understand it to simply be taking direct action at the site of recruiting, and in the Chicago area, that takes the form in many cases of, aside from military recruitment offices, they do a lot of outreach at public events and festivals and street fairs and things like that. But at the Taste of Chicago that day in July of 2006, they had a basketball hoop and like a free throw type contest and then a chin-up bar.
Now, were you disrupting those recruiters, or were you disrupting anything else at the Taste of Chicago? What were you doing?
I went there by myself and wasn't part of an organized effort. My effort was to try to say there's another side to this story. The military and, you know, war is not all fun and games. It's very serious. It's deadly. And if you are going to listen to recruiters, be sure to understand the other side of the story when they talk about college benefits, for instance. Know what's involved in that and how realistic your chances are. Just educate yourself so that you're not just getting their side of the story. I was sharing that message both orally and through posters and through handouts and being told to put all of those away at various points.
So you were counter-recruiting. Was there any other reason you went out there that day?
I had heard that people who were counter-recruiting on the opening night of Taste of Chicago had been shooed away by the police and being told to go to a free speech zone, which I thought was pretty amusing because my understanding is that, I mean, I thought Chicago is a free speech zone. This was a public park, a public festival, and they were told to go to a place about two blocks away where they would be, you know, so far from the message they were trying to give that it would be meaningless. And, you know, and it's funny because somebody I know actually went the next day, went up to the information booth at Taste of Chicago and asked where the free speech zone was. And there's no such thing. They were inventing it. It didn't exist. And so I had actually gone partly because I had heard that there was this free speech issue. So the first sign I was carrying simply said, Chicago is a free speech zone. And I was told to put that poster away. So then I put that poster in my purse and pulled out some flyers and was then, was handing out these flyers that I think were 10 things recruiters don't want you to know or something like that.
Was there a large police presence there?
Not at first, but then I guess the recruiters, these, you know, hefty military guys in uniforms must have been afraid of the likes of me in a pink hat or something. Not just me, but several of us. And I don't even know what the timing was on it, but all of a sudden there was a police line of probably 15 to 20 officers in a line between the recruiting booth and us.
For our Madison listeners who perhaps are unfamiliar with Mayor Daley's police force in Chicago, if you want to see what a police state will look like and looks like, in fact, currently, go to a big protest in Chicago. It's unbelievable, not only the sheer number of officers present, but the way they are dressed and prepared for battle. You call
it
them the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, I call it the Ninja outfit.
So what happened?
But it is a very intimidating presence.
Then you were arrested.
Yes, in the course of this time, one by one, various people were arrested. I was among the older of the crowd that was there. I mean, it was a very disparate group. I didn't know these people. So when I was arrested, I was snapping a photograph off of from the garbage can in the street. And when the police said, go get her. But I had been told to disperse. And I was shown where I should go, and I headed that direction and then looped back around and didn't come as close, but was leaning on a garbage can taking a photograph when I was arrested. And it wasn't really clear what activity I had just engaged in that caused them to do that, but there you have it.
Okay.
The world was protected from free speech now.
Well, according to something that I've recently read about your case, you were arrested for disorderly conduct, which is defined
Correct.
As three or more people committing acts, quote, likely to cause substantial, hard, or serious inconvenience, annoyance, or harm. Sounds like you were inconveniencing people trying to use that trash can?
I don't think so, and that's certainly not what was claimed against me. I mean, that disorderly conduct ordinance, I believe, has been in place for quite some time. So then it gives the police a very wide latitude to make a decision. And ultimately, my understanding is that it was disorderly conduct for failure to disperse upon a lawful order, which I used to be a lawyer. I'm not currently. But that, to me, begs the question, was there a lawful order? So Don Goldhammer and I, two of the defendants in this case, well, defendants at first, plaintiffs later, chose to make a federal case out of it, so to speak.
Well, way to go. So you were arrested, and then you sought to sue the city and then sought an injunction. Tell us an order.
Well, yes. I mean, before that, we had to appear numerous times and pay for a jury demand and, you know, go through a fair amount of inconvenience on several occasions before the judge, you know, finally getting fed up and seeing that the police weren't going to come, the witnesses against us weren't going to show up, finally dismissed the case against us when we were defendants in the criminal matter, which was a misdemeanor. And so then we flipped it around and sued as plaintiffs, and the two of us sued in federal court on the constitutionality of the disorderly conduct ordinance.
Right. And it was Judge Grady who decided that the ordinance was vague precisely because it gave the police too much discretion to curtail lawful, peaceful protest.
That's how I read it.
Right.
And it was a lengthy and very well thought out opinion, which is a lot more than a district court needs to do. I mean, he obviously felt very strongly about it, and we appreciated that opinion.
Well, that was the good news. And and then more recently, what happened?
Well, in September of this year, the appeals court, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, in a three-judge panel, after hearing oral arguments, found, you'd have to say they found against us in that they chose not to address the constitutionality of the ordinance, which means that the ordinance still stands, but their reasoning is really kind of interesting. They basically said, we can't really reach this because you and Mr. Goldhammer don't have standing to bring a case against the Chicago police because they misapplied the ordinance against you, which kind of begs the question to me. That suggests that it was so vague that it really couldn't be properly applied, but what do I know?
Well, I think that's very Orwellian, and it's kind of a sign of the times. You know, there's so many misnomers. Very Orwellian. You are unable to sue the city for doing something wrong because they did something wrong.
Right. I should point out that in addition to the federal claim for constitutionality, we did have other counts in our complaint that were more personal to us, like false imprisonment and things like that. And we did have a fairly modest monetary settlement. And the attorneys get most of that, and more power to them. They are truly the champions in this, National Lawyers Guild attorneys who helped us out. And I should point out that almost in the time since that settlement took place, which was a little over a year ago, the city is starting to take a harder line and choosing not to make those kinds of monetary settlements, but rather to fight them, which I find pretty interesting, and I wonder if our case had any bearing on that, and I'm not sure which way that would cut if it did.
Well, the important thing is that you're not in jail and that people should know that they can protest and they can demonstrate and practice dissent. And as for now, at least, the law will protect them, even though it's arduous, unnecessarily so.
And Steve, I want to point out something. You mentioned Mayor Daley's police state. The first time I recall ever hearing the concept of a free speech zone was in Chicago in 1996 when the Democratic National Convention was here, and that was put in place by Mayor Daley. As much as I am appalled by things that went on the last 8 years under the Bush administration, this was a much more local effort, and it seems to have almost started here.
Well, Robin Shermer, that's a fascinating tale. Good luck not getting arrested at any actions you might engage in the future. And we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us on Health Writers.
Well, thank you for giving me an opportunity to share my story.
Well, that concludes this week's Health Writers on the Air. I am setting up a special section on our website at healthwriters.wordpress.com. And this section will be dedicated to the contributions Judy Lerquin has made to this program over the years. Finally, I want to thank Mighty Ken Rainier for coming through and engineering our program again tonight. Good night.